Give me everything you've got. I'll take what I can get.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your all that is solid melts into air of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Before you, his mother, before him.
That's right, 2 weeks in a row with physics at the top, because you know we love technology, we love science on podcast. Okay, you're listening to the opening track from the Boy Genius album. It's Without You, Without Them, Boy Genius. As I am certain that you know, it is the triumvirate of Phoebe Bridgers, Julian Baker, Lucy Dacus, who just put out their collective debut album. There was an EP a few years ago, but the first full-length album just came out. We're going to get into that. We're going to get into, I would venture to say, micro-generations of indie rock in the last 10 to 15 years. And as been pointed out to me by one of our guests this week, a little bit of backlash, a little bit of a capital D discourse that's been going on around this record that we are going to dive into or maybe dance around. We'll see when we get there. John Perellis is here first. JP, what's good, man?
I'm back. I'm a terrible dancer, though, so I don't know how much dancing I'm going to be doing.
You dance with the keyboard, dancing fingers atop the letters.
There we go.
JP reviewed the Boy Genius album for us at the paper. Boy Genius album was a critic's pick. It was also a best new music at Pitchfork, written by Kat Zhang, associate editor at Pitchfork, second time on Popcast. Kat, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Excited that you're here, and it is Kat who pointed to the discourse. But like, we're going to like point at it for a sec, and then we're going to put it on a shelf, and then we're going to come back to it. Let's maybe start with a little bit of context. Kat, I believe in your review, you talked about the origin story of Boy Genius as a trio. And I wonder if we can maybe get into that a tiny bit about how these individuals chose to form this entity and why was slash is it meaningful that this entity exists separate from any of their solo work?
They were all young singer-songwriters. I think they were all in their early 20s around the time that they met each other, and they were kind of rising, you know, had this similar arc to each other. And then Lucy Dacus and Julian Baker met first. They were, I think, playing a show together, and they met in the green room. And all of the members of Boy Genius are big book readers. So at the time, Lucy was reading Henry James's Portrait of the Lady, and Julian was like, oh my God, I know I'm going to be friends with this person. And then I think a similar thing transpired between Julian Baker and Phoebe Bridgers. And so the three of them decided that they, you know, they needed to all get together. And, you know, like when you're in your early 20s and you're like kind of starting in this career, especially one that's, you know, like being an artist where you're exposed to the feedback of so many people and you're like probably talking to labels and all these professionals, like it can be really isolating. I think they're saying interviews, you know, you just like at that age and also being young women, you like lack the certitude and the confidence to be like, no, this is my idea. I am right. Let me like try to push my vision. But when they were interacting with each other, I think they were able to give each other a lot of community and support. And so they could feel better about their own respective ideas. And so they were going to be touring together, and they thought they would maybe go in the studio and record one single to kind of promote that tour. And they, over the course of 4 days, ended up with 6 songs. So that was the origin of Boy Genius.
JP, can we talk a little bit about the concept of supergroup, and you can use that term between quote marks or not, but the concept of people who have established careers, even if at this particular point in the careers of these three individuals, those careers were still sort of starting out. They were still in the early phases, but people who have individual careers, individual fan bases coming together for a common purpose. Can we talk a little bit about the history of that and what are some of the motivations that people have historically chosen that?
Well, I think Kat brought up part of it, which is you have a very small peer group. You don't have a lot of people you know who have gone through the same experience. And supergroups tend to be unstable, tend to be blind faith, for instance, or Crosby, Stills, and Nash, even, who broke up and got together and broke up and got together. You got to have a pretty big ego to be a singer, songwriter, solo artist. And I suspect there are ego clashes But I spoke to another super group, I'm With Her, which is Sarah Jarosz, Ife O'Donovan, and Sarah Watkins. And they said when they got together, they realized that the interaction between three women was different from any of the other collaborations they'd done with men, that they were more supportive of each other, that they listened to each other, that there was less pulling of rank. So I think it's probably nurturing and comforting for the members of Boy Genius to just hang out with each other, you know, to tell each other, yeah, I went through that too. Yeah, that was rough. Yeah, that idiot told me to do this with my hair, whatever. It's a bulwark in a way to know that other people have been there and gone through it.
Did Boy Genius, in your mind, Kat, take on some symbolic weight that was maybe even bigger than the recorded output prior to this? Not talking about this album or this cycle. I mean, more in the 2018, 2019 moment.
I imagine for a lot of young women, it was really inspirational to see three young women, three queer young women who could have embarked on their own solo arcs come together and to try to work together. And then, you know, even now where it's like Phoebe Bridgers has this huge solo career, the fact that they still decided that they wanted to work together, developing that friendship and that collaboration, that was something they wanted to pursue. Like, that also seems really meaningful in this context too.
JP, do you think that this album specifically, to what degree is it in line with the solo work that each of these three has put out? Or do you think that this kind of album is a refuge of a kind for a different kind of, whether it's songwriting or production style? And the record is called, just for the record, it's called The Record. Sorry, that was a lot of echoes. I apologize for that.
Don't forget the lowercase.
That's true.
I actually think that what they do is temper each other. They temper each other and they egg each other on. Julian Baker's a little less tortured on this. Phoebe Bridgers is a little less wispy on this. Lucy Dacus is a little less earnest on this. They're having fun. There's joy in the way they egg each other on, but they also, you know, sharpen each other, which is how a group should work. You can tell they're really listening to each other, which is a great example for human society. I always thought the ideal of a rock band is such a utopian thing. And at least on this record, even more than the EP, it seems that that's what they really strove for.
Kat, what do you make of that? How do you feel that this record dialogues with the individual solo work?
I do think that there is some aspect of pulling each other into different corners. So I really appreciate how Julian is trying to urge the others to be a little louder and a little noisier. And I think, you know, some of the songs that she leads seem to me like the most effective ones. Maybe there are some more glib lines that strike me as like kind of Phoebe things, but that might be delivered by a different person. But I do think that like a lot of their stuff from their solo records like come through on this, especially when it comes to Phoebe. Kind of mentioned in my review, like a lot of the songs that she is leading sound like things on Punisher. And maybe if I had to issue like critique, I do think I would have liked for less of that to happen and for some of her songs for there to be a slightly more collaborative feel.
One thing that I was struck by, especially in the first half of the album, was they felt like solo songs that then everybody else kind of showed up and said, I can bring this, I can do this, I can do this. I felt like here's a Julian Baker song, and then Lucy and Phoebe show up and are kind of like, okay, great, I can handle this thing at the chorus, or I can kind of thicken it up at the bridge. I felt like that was happening almost in rotation, one Phoebe, one Julian, one Lucy on the front half of the record. Do we know much about the actual songwriting process as far as did folks come into the room with things pre-written? Was stuff written IRL altogether? Do we have a sense of how the actual lyrics came together here?
So I think it originated like right after Phoebe finished and released Punisher. She had this demo that was Emily, I'm Sorry. And she sent it to the other two as sort of like, hey, can we get the band back together? Emily, I'm Sorry really does seem like a Punisher cut. So
yeah, my main note on that song is Bridger's solo.
Yeah. And then the first four songs on the record, including sort of that initial trio, or, you know, if it feels like a Julian song, a Phoebe song, and a Lucy song. I mean, they did write those separately. And then they, I think, spent a month in the studio together, just like working on songs together. And maybe before that, they put a lot of ideas into Google Drive. Something I am not sure about is whether they wanted to make it intentional that some of the songs felt more distinctly like one person's lane. Kind of, you know, in the vein of friendship, it's like each person is really valued for their like distinct qualities. Like maybe in like romantic relationships, it's when you theorize it, it's more about like the blend, like the couple as a unit. But I think in friendship, it's more about like how individuals like shine and then they come together. So maybe there is an intention to structure the album in that way, or maybe it was unintentional and we're just getting these sort of like distinct moments of Phoebe-ness and Julian-ness.
Let's listen to Emily, I'm Sorry, which is a very good song, but is very much like ineffably a Phoebe song that other people are showing up to, including us. To take it back actually to what we listened to at the beginning of the episode, Without You, Without Them, you know, this very intense harmonizing, you know, it feels like In the Round singing. That feels very pointed. It's a pointed way, you know, to build on what we were just talking about. It's a pointed way to open an album with three very strong individual personalities to say, no, we are all intertwined. We're all in service of a common sound. JP, can you talk to me a little bit about statement of purpose opening like that, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's a bunch of that on the EP from a few years ago. Maybe even the ending of the EP is like that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of Boy Genius cinematic universe going on this record. The EP ends with Ketchum, Idaho, Ketchum ID.
Yes.
Which ends with three-part harmony. I think it was an extremely deliberate move to start the new album with three-part harmony. It's also a statement of, we're doing this alone, but we're doing this together. It's a statement of shared, unified purpose, everybody sharing every word. But it's also like, yeah, you remember our EP, don't you? This is how it ended. You can segue right in. Put it in your playlist.
Yeah, it'd be a seamless streaming experience from track 6 of the EP into track 1 of the album.
And there's more callbacks, too. Letter to an Old Poet takes the melody from Me and My Dog from the EP and turns it from forlorn to I'm moving on. There's a lot of, sometimes I think there are too many Easter eggs.
I would agree with that, maybe. Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, is it, we talk a lot on podcasts in a lot of contexts about fan service and fan enthusiasm, right? And I think we tend to think of those things largely in the context of pop megastars and, you know, K-pop icons and Rihanna and Taylor and so on and so forth. But certainly the online fan economy around Phoebe Bridgers is extremely intense. And Boy Genius, you know, this is not a huge pop act, but I think, JP, that note about the Boy Genius cinematic universe is really well taken. These are individuals, especially Phoebe, and a group in which there is lore. Lore is very, very important to Phoebe and to Boy Genius. Kat, you want to pick up on that idea? Because I don't think we often see this intensity of lore with groups of this equivalent size or artists of this equivalent size.
I'm still like kind of trying to figure out where I land on this. I mean, maybe Phoebe took a page from the Taylor Swift school of Easter egging or whatever. Right. I do think that maybe like one of the things that makes it okay, I could see an argument for it, which is like, I mean, this is, you know, an album about friendship and about a close, intimate bond. And so, you know, in a friendship, you're going to have all these like inside jokes and yeah, you're going to have like Easter eggs within the context of your friendship. And maybe they want to kind of extend that intimacy to their fans. But maybe one of the reasons why the Easter egging is sort of not so effective is because sometimes it can just come off as like an attempt at cleverness that doesn't really work in a larger context, or maybe it doesn't really give people a way to buy in if they aren't so like deep in the weeds of the discography and the lore and on TikTok and like looking at the conspiracies and that kind of thing.
Do you think that it's possible to experience this album without all that other stuff in a successful way? Like, obviously all things function on multiple levels. People bring different histories and backstories and knowledge sets to it. But is there something about this album that remains closed off without access to that additional layer of conversation?
I do think that if you like are not already tuned into their solo careers, and maybe like the first Boy Genius EP, you just like might not like this as much. But I think like there's still some nice writing on here. And I think like the general theme of love, friendship, camaraderie, all of those things like resonate, even if you're not deep in internet lore.
I don't think you have to be a cult member to like this record. Think about songs like Cool About It. It's a cooperative song. They each take a verse. They each give the verse their own solo style. But at the same time, it's a very well-written song about what happens when you run into your ex in the street. And that's a pretty universal, pardon the expression, relatable experience. Plus, it's just got a pretty melody. With a touch of the boxer from Paul Simon.
Wish You Were Kind Enough to Be Cruel About It is a Julian Baker line on that, that I was like, damn, that's hard. That's extremely hard. Great line.
Cool About It is definitely one of my favorites on the record. I think like maybe a more specific scenario than even just running into an ex is almost like trying, like when you date one of your friends and you have this like such a close intimate bond and you know everything about them. And then you have to like, for whatever reason, sort of break up, but continue to preserve the peace. Maybe like kind of a more queer reading of it. And it is just like so acutely painful to sort of pretend that you don't know everything about them for the sake of like the larger unity or something like that. I thought that was a cool thing to explore in that song.
Let's listen to a little bit of Cool About It. And we're going to go to a quick break and then we're going to be back right after that.
I came prepared for absolution if you'd only ask. So I take some offense when you say no regrets. I remember it's impossible to pass your test. But I'm trying to forget about.
Are you familiar with the parable of the boiled frog?
I'm Estelle Herndon, the host of The Run-Up from The New York Times.
I believe so, but I would need a reminder.
Okay. Give it to us.
For 6 years, I've had a hard time getting establishment Republicans to say publicly what they've all said privately about Donald Trump. Then, the midterms happened.
So you can put a frog in boiling water and it'll jump out, right? But if you put a frog in a pot of water and then turn up the heat, he'll eventually cook to death without jumping out, right? So we became that frog.
For the past few months, we've been reporting from inside the political establishment as they try to figure out their path forward behind closed doors. This season, we go behind those doors. You can find new episodes of The Run-Up on Thursdays, wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. John Perales is here. Kat Zhang is here. One thing that I kind of wanted to talk about the songwriting on this record, both as compared to the EP and the individual solo work. To me, the songwriting felt like a tiny bit more general. And this is where the lore conversation is sort of funny, because I think these songs in some places feel less preoccupied with like a micro detail, which I think is something that Phoebe and Julian especially do incredibly well. But is it a little bit more general and therefore a little bit more big tent?
There's still a lot of very particular details. There's not a lot of cliche. There's not a lot of simple love songs. One thing I love about this album is all the ambivalence and all the feelings. All of the feelings are complicated, just about. There's the occasional profession of camaraderie or friendship or love, but there's also hedging and second thoughts and self-doubt. I mean, I love all the ambivalence in this, frankly.
Maybe what you're thinking about, John, is it seems like this album has a bit more of a concept and kind of scaffolding where it's like they are all friends. And then this is an album that is in some ways about friendship or the nature of like being close to each other. Whereas like the EP didn't have as much of like an overarching concept and, you know, each song was about a different thing. And so then the lines that maybe hit is like, it feels good to be known so well, which is kind of a truism about that experience of being a friend, of loving someone, those kinds of things.
Can you talk a little bit more about that architecture? Because again, it ties into the larger conversation about lore, right? It's like it's the Boy Genius EP is sort of a charming, seemingly at the moment, potentially one-off union of people who are individually beloved. Now it is a full-fledged character. Can you talk about the ways in which the album tells the story of its creators, not simply individual micro moments where they're reflecting on individual interactions?
To step back and maybe allude to some of the sort of like discourse that we might talk about later, like I think a lot of what people have been bristling against partially is that they think that, in the press, there's the press has promoted some kind of idea that like Boy Genius is like they invented friendship. And I think the reason that, you know, friendship is discussed so much is not just like, it's not just that they are friends, but also that the subject of this album is friendship. And I think they render it in a kind of really nice way, starting from the beginning song Without You, Without Them, which is kind of honoring each other's families and the way that family history and sort of like inheritance plays a role in shaping people. But then there's also this request to like be a part of each other's lineage and each other's family. And then the sort of meta part of it is also then there's like Without You, Without Them is a continuation of Ketchum ID. So there's kind of referencing like their already, the history they already have together. And then you have songs like We're in Love, you know, even from the title, you're like getting the gist of it, where it's filled with all of these like inside references between them, but is also making this claim that's like, this is not just like sisterhood. And it's not like this cute thing. Like we are actually in love with each other. We have this, these people in this band are a huge part of my life. Lucy Dacus is just important to Phoebe Bridgers as Paul Mescal, if not more, you know, that kind of thing.
Does Paul Mescal know? just wondering. Paul, popcastnytimes.com if you're curious, we'll tap in. I'm trying to think of equivalent examples of groups that foreground their own intimacy. What I keep landing on, unfortunately, is like maybe slightly more adversarial versions of this, like a Fleetwood Mac or something. JP, are there other groups of this nature that you can think of who are wanting to tell you the story of the kind of intergroup joy and comfort as a leading principle?
Every country duet?
You think?
A lot of country duets.
I guess I only like the sad ones or the tortured ones.
you like the bickering ones.
Yeah, seriously.
They do not bicker on this album. It is true. I'm going to take a weird left turn here, which is to say how California this album is. I mean, LA is Bridgers' home territory. They made the album in Malibu at Rick Rubin's Shangri-La. Fleetwood Mac is in the sound of this. Not Strong Enough is a definite gloss on the Sheryl Crow song. There's a lot of thought about rock lore in Boy Genius. I mean, they posed their first album cover to look like Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They posed like Nirvana on the cover of Rolling Stone. They're thinking a lot about the classic rock heritage that they're playing with and willing to shoulder, but also willing to continue. This album feels very glossy in a Los Angeles way. I mean, even when it goes into grunge, it's a kind of a smoother, classier, more multi-track grunge. I like the sound of it a lot, but it does feel like they're trying to exemplify that place, and that's Bridgers' home turf, right? She was born there. But the other two are definitely joining her on that sonic turf.
Should we lean into a little bit of discourse? I'm like a little bit loath to because I kind of think it's like low grade. TBH, but it does seem to be a lot louder than it was 4 days ago when I first thought, like, hey, we should do an episode about Point Genius. So what's the big, let's just talk, like, what's the big, so, like, the big umbrella? We don't have to, like, get into, like, specific darts, but the big umbrella is, like, is Boy Genius, is it, like, mall music? Is it edgeless? Is, I feel like, at least some of the conversation.
I feel like the conversation is, like, is Boy Genius overrated, which is kind of a just and I think, like, that line of inquiry has been coming for them. You know, I feel like there's all this backlash towards Phoebe specifically that's been brewing, but then I think probably towards all three of them. And I can see why people would be maybe unnerved by just, like, a lot of, like, really positive press just coming out all at once. And I think reading some of, like, the early media about them, yeah, maybe there was a strand of it that was, like, overemphasizing the unity between the three of them, where it's like, you can't even tell, like, who wrote what, and it's, like, perfect harmony. And maybe, like, that narrative does a disservice or is, like, lightly, like, infantilizing to the three women, which is just to all say, like, in the context of, like, really loud fan bases and, like, a lot of glowing press, you know, I understand why people would be frustrated, and everyone is allowed to push, like, the hater button sometimes. Like, that is necessary for, like, critical discourse.
That's not what Ed Sheeran says, just FYI. But, you know, it's a different kind of artist. But anyway, please.
They're minor whiffs of, like, misogyny, or some of it is just, like, I'm seeing too much of them and I'm frustrated about it, or it's, like, maybe misdirected anger. And I think there is a little bit of it where it's, like, there's the kind of critique of this being Urban Outfitters music. I'm like, Urban Outfitters just, like, picks what's popular in a certain vein to put in their store. So, of course, they would sound like Urban Outfitters music because they're popular.
But also, it's like, what does that mean? I mean, I think you're right to kind of, like, tease out a touch of the misogyny underneath that. But also, it feels like a weird debate. It feels like a very 90s debate to be like, oh, this, like, palatability in so much as it is, that is bad. Or, like, that, or that would be somehow, like, something to avoid. And JP, you bring up the Californian-ness of the record, which I think is maybe the musical description of this kind of negative or resistant streak in the discourse about it. And it's odd to me that in 2023 that people are still pointing at that and being like, that's unserious, that sound. That seems weird to me.
All of these people are listening to Death Grips all the time, right?
I mean, talk about people I pray for. Jeez.
Somebody's just like, beef gets attention. You know, it's like, let's latch onto something that people are talking about and be contrarian. I really do think there's a strong streak of that. And it wouldn't matter if it were Ed Sheeran or something as good as Boy Genius. But also, I mean, take a song like $20, $20, whatever it's called. That's a stomper. That's, you know, that's not going down easy. That's not your gentle acoustic ballad.
Great moment to listen to $20 or $20.
It's a bad idea, and I'm all about it. Give it one more chance, and then I finally had it. When you wake up,
is it not on some level just the fate of any acclaimed artist to have a backlash cycle, number one? The second question, and we were chatting about this very briefly before we started recording, there is something about, like, the particular microcycles of indie rock in the last, like, 10, 15 years. This album feels, you know, if we're really going to play this game, maybe feels a little bit more 2019 or 2020, pre-pandemic. It feels a little bit more like that than of the specific moment. I feel like the stuff that's the more exciting stuff now is, like, a little bit louder, a little bit more jangly, a little bit more abrasive in places. This does feel reminiscent of a different time and of a different set of artists and a different micro movement. Is some of it just maybe slightly out of place? Look, an album comes out when it comes out. You don't fault the album for coming out in this year versus that year. But I wonder if because of the narrative cycles of Boy Genius and also the bigger picture of the lore. Were people so excited about Boy Genius before there was even the album to be excited about? And then by the time the album arrived, maybe that balance, the scale had like recalibrated a little bit. Is any of that at play?
I think some of these hype cycles are a little too accelerated. They recorded the album, most of it in January 2022, which is already a year ago. Before that, there was the pandemic, which was, as we know, a complete epistemological breach and, you know, changed everybody's vision of time. So, you know, 2019 isn't that far away. And
I don't know. I was looking at my best albums lists from 17, 18, and 19. That feels like 100 years ago.
But also, I mean, they're looking back further. They're looking back to the 70s. They're looking back to the Pixies. They are being classic rock. They are being deliberately vintage in a way. I think they've chosen their idiom and made it work for them. These are their skills. I mean, if you listen to Little Oblivions, there's a lot of 90s in it. There's a lot of U2 in that album. If you listen to any Phoebe Bridges album, there's a lot of 70s Laurel Canyon in it. These are not people who are deciding to crash sonic frontiers. On the other hand, I think that this album does have a lot more just pure musical playfulness and experimentalism than the EP did.
What's a song that really sticks out to you as being musically unexpected?
The end of Revolution Zero, where it just floats into this total ethereal other world.
Let's listen to that outro, or near outro, on Revolution Zero. Kat, what do you make of that, the sort of both the playfulness and also the bigger conversation about what traditions Boy Genius is aligning itself with, and also how do those traditions play in this current specific moment of indie rock?
In terms of the playfulness, I think there are definitely like light electronic touches in songs like Not Strong Enough or Emily, I'm Sorry, that feel a bit new for them. And I actually would have really loved for them to explore that. I actually want to talk about the sort of like passage of time element. This is like a kind of a working theory, like it's not fully formed, but I think like during the pandemic, there's a lot of people who were reckoning with their sexuality on TikTok. There are a lot of young women reading this Google Doc called The Lesbian Master Doc. The title was like, Am I Gay? And it was like a series of questions sort of like analyzing, helping you assess how compulsory heterosexuality might have made you think that you were straight, but maybe not. I wonder if like, because a lot of people went through that period of like interpersonal reckoning, tapping into the spirit of like Adrian Rich, whether that also is what makes this album really resonate for like a specific young audience. And I do think that like some of the people who seem more cynical about this album are maybe slightly older, where a line that I've heard is like, look, like people in bands are saying that they love each other all the time, and then they break up and it's so acrimonious. So like, why are we supposed to believe that like these people love each other? Maybe there's even a light hint in the discourse that this is like a PR thing. But I think like, you know, as a young woman, like I would love to believe in this love. I think it is like really cool to see an album that is about like a really strong relationship between queer women that also like troubles this idea of like a strict division between like friendship and romance, and that it feels like a, you know, a more novel aspect of the record to me that then also taps into like this sort of thinking and reflection that a lot of young people might have been going through during the pandemic.
The sort of gap between the positive reaction to the record and the maybe more cynical reaction, if we're going to look at spaces like TikTok, which Kat, I know you spend a lot of time in, as do I, can we talk about how people are narrativizing this record in those spaces? Does it lean more into the embrace of kind of queer romance, queer friendship, and these kind of like blurred lines? Is that how it's being received in those spaces?
I've definitely seen quite a few TikToks in that vein, although like my algorithm is just like putting a very specific lane of things onto my feed. I mean, usually anytime like any big album comes out, I get like a flood of like positive videos. But I do think that like there's younger audience who are picking up on these things. And then maybe the more cynical reaction is happening on Twitter.
That could be said of so many things, not simply the Boy Genius album. That's the truism across almost all cultural production. Before we sort of wrap it up, JP, is there anything else that you wanted to kind of draw attention to from the album or from its reception?
Not so much the reception, but I want to talk about how much this album is about feeling still unformed. This is not about having necessarily a mission statement and a strategic plan. A lot of these songs are about mixed feelings, mixed emotions, ambivalence, ambiguity, amorphousness. I mean, there's two songs in a row in the opening run of individual songs. Bridger sings, and Emily, I'm sorry, she sings, I'm 27 and I don't know who I am. And then the Dacus song, True Blue, goes, when you don't know who you are, you f*** around to find out. The whole album is about trying to figure out what's going on between these three songwriters, between these songwriters and their friends and lovers, between these songwriters and the outside world. And they're not saying we figured it all out. I like it that it's not all or nothing. I like it that it's not yes or no. I like it that it's not one or zero. It actually feels like a throwback to analog 70s days when things could be blurry and unresolved and would draw you in because of that uncertainty.
Yeah, what do you make of that as far as the relationship to resolution, and especially for a group that's opening with harmony to let you know how aligned they are as a group, but you have songwriting that then dives into how unsettled folks are on an individual level?
I don't think that those things are actually that in contrast with each other, because I think one of the themes is like, yeah, you're 27, 28, you're figuring yourself out, you're so malleable, and these other people in your life are shaping you, and that can be a really fraught process. It can also be a really wonderful process. So the sort of opening track is kind of an embrace of the way that you might be changed, and these ambiguities might turn into something different or lead you into a new direction. I also like to say, I'm 27 and I don't know who I am. So real.
It probably holds true at 33 and 37 and 43 and 49. It's also universal. You know, we might be getting Boy Genius albums in the year of our Lord 2055 that say, you know, I'm 43 and I don't know who I am. And that's okay. That's okay.
They're going to know then.
No, I don't know. I want to embrace everybody who has arrived at heavy middle age and still hasn't figured it out. Pofcat, we are here for you. We are here for you. Let's go out with something. Actually, I'd love to go out with something from the EP, because I feel like we didn't get to spend a lot of time on the EP. But I think for me, at least, I kind of prefer the EP. But I wonder if we should go out with something. What should we listen to?
Bite the Hand.
Probably Me and My Dog.
Not to outvote you, JP, but I was leaning towards Me and My Dog.
Me and My Dog, go for it.
Okay, so we're going to go out with Me and My Dog. That is our show. Thank you to Kat. Thank you to JP. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get the shirt. It's thepopcast.myshopify.com. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. tinyurl.com/podcast/discord/podcast/facebook. And subscribe anywhere you get your audio content. Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, yada, 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 yada. We are in all those places. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. This is Me and My Dog. I never said I'd be-